is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of a hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, my friends, welcome to another week in the weird. I'm your host, the mouth of the South himself, Micah Hanks. This is the Grillion Report. And we're all a little concerned down here in the bunker tonight, but I'm going to tell you here and now, of all places I could possibly be, I'm very glad that I'm in a bunker. That's right. I'll tell you why here in just a moment. Lots of interesting stuff to get to on tonight's program, and I'm doing a double shift because I'm going to do this broadcast, and then I'm going to hang out for about 5 hours and then go on live in the wee hours of Wednesday with George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM to discuss the Ghost Rockets. It's going to be a great time, a busy time, interesting times, I think, as the ancient Chinese curse goes. Oh, and look across the board here from me in Grillion International Studios, pushing buttons and making faces tonight, Mr. Caleb Hanks in the house.
Hello!
Hi, Caleb. How are you?
I'm wonderful. It's good to be back in the bunker.
Always good to have you here. Yeah, we've been graced with a lot of interesting, I guess as that ancient Chinese curse goes, we've been graced with a lot of interesting times here in the bunker. It's not a curse, it's been great. I've been having a ball.
Reminds me, wise man once said, the reason that I've been single for so long is probably that cursed medallion. Why do I have that thing?
Yeah, why do I carry that thing around anyway? getting right to the news here. Scientists now say that Fukushima radiation could arrive by April.
My favorite.
Yeah.
Just in time for our birthday.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. In fact, they're actually saying that on the birthday of the Hanks brothers, April 17th, no, I'm kidding, actually, what they're really saying is that nearly 3 years after the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant melted down following a massive earthquake, they're saying now that radioactive elements from the disaster could reach the coast of California. Now, scientists on Monday said that they've spent the last few months dismissing a series of shrill reports, to put it mildly, that say that radiation from the disaster has already washed up on California shores. Apparently, that is not the case. So, no need for alarm until April.
Mommy, where does radiation come from?
We all know it comes from giant monsters that lurk beneath the Pacific Ocean. But anyway, an oceanographer, Ken Buesler, stated to the press, specifically I think the San Francisco Chronicle, that there was no evidence of radiation yet, but by April, traces of cesium, one of the telltale elements from the meltdown, could appear in low levels on the California coast. Now, Buesler and volunteers are monitoring seawater collected in 18 sites on the West Coast and in Hawaii for the cesium elements, since federal agencies at present aren't. But once the water in April is tested, Californians should know if Fukushima is truly here, if it's made its way all the way to the West Coast, or if we're just falling victim to fear-mongering on the internet.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of a contentious situation. It always is, especially when it involves, nuclear radiation. Moving with ease, taking its sweet time, and finally lurching its way over to the west coast of the United States. A lot of people are concerned about this. And it reminds me of something else, Caleb. Have you seen this new Godzilla trailer?
I have, and it scared the crap out of me.
I'll tell you, if folks out there have not seen this, I've got it linked up over on GrayleonReport.com. And I urge you, if you'd like a good thrill, to go check this thing out. Now, he or she, whichever it is, Godzilla, is only visible for a couple of seconds, but it does make a cameo in this trailer, and we get a good look down the gullet of the great big one.
Yeah. He has to eat killer whales, probably, for breakfast.
Yeah, killer whales. Actually, blue whales. This guy's probably big enough to swallow a I'm telling you, I think they've made him bigger than ever before in this film. At very least, or maybe it's just the angles and the cinematography, because this one's got a much darker, more devastating tone to it. But I'm telling you, I mean, the look of this film, I think that would sum it all up right there. It's darker, it's meaner, it's more atmospheric.
It's got Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad in it. He's a pretty dark dude.
Yeah, right. Gareth Edwards, I believe, is the director. 20th. Let's see here. What's the company that's actually doing this? Legendary Pictures?
Yeah, Legendary.
Yeah. Yeah, and I tell you, this trailer really, I mean, it takes a lot to spook me these days, but it's just, there's a masterful use of color and imagery. You know, this you can tell is not just going to be a scary movie. It's not just going to be a kaiju flick. It's going to be something that is a brilliant piece of cinematography from the looks of things. But you know, it reminded me of something.
Cloverfield?
No, not at all. Just the opposite. See, that's just it. This looks a lot better than Cloverfield. That wasn't a terrible film, but, you know, it wasn't what this is looking like it's going to be, and I hope they don't disappoint us. But if you go over to GrayleyReport.com and you check out, this trailer, I've got an image link there that has nothing to do with Godzilla, aside from the fact that the colors kind of remind me of it. And what you're actually seeing there is a photograph that was taken at around maybe 11:30, somewhere between maybe 11:30 and midnight, from Honolulu. But that was during the 1962, that the Operation Starfish Prime high-altitude nuclear explosion was tested over the Pacific Ocean. Interestingly enough, I think it was carried aboard I want to say it was a Titan rocket that was launched from Johnston Atoll. And they launch this thing from Johnston Island. It shoots up into the upper atmosphere, and they detonate this nuclear weapon. And that photograph was taken, and it shows the sky glowing red over the Pacific Ocean. And interestingly, get this, there wasn't a resounding electromagnetic pulse that knocked out the electrical grid there in Honolulu for several hours, maybe several days. I don't recall. But, you know, you got to keep in mind that a lot of the old electronic equipment, the tube transistors and stuff that they used back in those days, it was a little stouter than what we have these days. Experts on the potential threat of EMP today say that, you know, back in the old days, the old electrical equipment might have actually lasted. Nowadays, everything's so fragile that if there were a similar incident where a high-altitude nuclear explosion took place like that, it could wipe out the technical or the electrical grid for who knows how long.
Tunguska style.
Yeah. It could be dangerous. So, all that to say, the imagery I'm seeing in this Godzilla trailer actually reminds me quite a bit, Caleb, of the imagery associated with the actual nuclear tests back in the 1960s.
The first trailer was really, really cool, just the teaser, because it actually had Oppenheimer's speech in the beginning of it, talking about witnessing a nuclear blast, and I thought, like, how epic.
God, yeah.
How fitting.
Well, you know, listeners of this program are familiar with that, no doubt. Oppenheimer, of course, It's incredible. I ran into a guy up at Paradigm Symposium this past October, and it was actually, I think, the night before the actual event. And we were doing some setting up, and this gentleman comes up to me, and I was in touch with him one time via email after that, and then we didn't correspond anymore, which I found kind of strange. I don't know why necessarily. But this guy was really interested in the nuclear era, but he was primarily a philosopher, and he starts talking to me, and Oppenheimer came up in the conversation, and bastards, they're all bastards, you know, all of them, talking about all the people, you know, from the nuclear era and all this. And I found it very, very interesting talking with this gentleman. Ronald was his name. But, you know, Oppenheimer, there have been a lot of stories about Oppenheimer over the years. People have tried to allege that, you know, he was, a socialist, a commie, you know, that was trying to infiltrate the United States. I think he'd actually been a member of the Communist Party, if I remember correctly. I know he'd been involved with a girl, I think, who got him interested in all that.
I've been to a few Communist parties.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
They're not very fun.
Yeah, hanging downtown with the commie mommy, yeah. But, you know, Oppenheimer was obviously very regretful. And he knew, as he observed that first test explosion at Alamogordo, that they were onto something big. I mean, it was obviously big, but it was terrifying. And I think that these people were obviously very regretful. And there's that famous piece of footage that I think CBS may have aired. And it shows Oppenheimer sitting there, tearful. And he's talking about the first time that they saw the Trinity explosion. He called it Trinity. He's sitting there, and he's looking down, and he says, "And as I saw this, the lines from the Bhagavad Gita came to me, and they were, now I am become death, destroyer of worlds." And, you know, the whole conversation about Godzilla is inextricably linked to the discussion of, well, you know, the horrors of nuclear war. And in fact, you know, that first Godzilla that came out in 1954, I think Ishiro Honda was the director. That first film, I mean, it was all commentary Godzilla himself representative of the horrors of war. And, of course, what historically we know ended the Pacific Theater, the Second World War, with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
I mean, it was filmed just a few years afterwards, and if I'm not mistaken, there were actual, like debris and rubble from the actual event in some parts of the film.
I wouldn't doubt it. It was filmed, I guess, actually, maybe within 10 years of the close of World War II, but still, I mean, you know, close enough to where you'll never get far enough away, as a matter of fact. There couldn't be enough time that will pass to reduce the extremity and the horror of what we witnessed during the Second World War, and not just at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I say all that to kind of highlight the fact that, you know, Godzilla has and does, and I think always will, kind of represent the darkest elements of humanity, blown up and exemplified in a giant, deadly, prehistoric thing whose power is amplified even further by the nuclear radiation that he's been exposed to. But there's this interesting twist in this new 2014 installment here. And Caleb, did you pick up on this in the trailer? They were alluding to the fact that the nuclear tests weren't what had... They may have actually made him bigger. I don't know.
Yeah, but they say that they were using that to kill him.
Yeah, exactly. That's an interesting twist on the whole thing, that rather than awakening him from some primordial sleep or some sort of a suspended animation, that this...
Or that was the cause of his mutation and he was an iguana. I think that was the explanation in that unanimously hated Matthew Broderick version from 2000.
That movie, yeah. It was just absurd.
You know, honestly, I didn't hate that movie. I think for its time, I just love watching anything where a giant monster is, like, destroying stuff. But
didn't we see that in theaters?
I think we did.
I didn't hate it. I wouldn't say I hated. Hate's a very strong word, and that's the whole thing about Godzilla. Godzilla went from being this terribly destructive monster to being kind of a good guy along the way.
Well, I think, honestly, I think there's a social happening that is going on that's kind of unspoken, where I think somebody on the internet one day said, I hated that Matthew Broderick Godzilla, and somebody else was like, yeah, I hated it too. And now you talk to anybody and they're all like, that movie is a piece of crap. But I mean, really, for its time, the computer animation was pretty incredible for, you know, what they were doing with it. But
yeah, Kayla, by the way, I'm sorry, we've got a real big problem here. There's a bunch of people in the chat room, and some of them are saying that they can't get the Godzilla trailer to load at the same time as the Graylin report.
Oh no!
That is a serious problem right there. No, I'm kidding. But they're actually posting images of Godzilla there in the chat room. So, if you're not in the chat room, by the way, you're missing out. You got to jump in there Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on graylinreport.com/podcast and radio. Just go to the top of the page at graylinreport.com and you can click the little link there. And with that, I think we've got to run out and pay a couple of bills here, Caleb. But when we come back, no, we're actually, funny enough, not going anywhere. We're going to stay right here in the bunker. I'm not leaving the bunker until this Godzilla movie comes out, in fact. I'm going to be the only guy in June who doesn't have a tan because he stayed hundreds of miles underground until this movie hit the series or the silver screen. So I'm going to be really interested in seeing this. There are very few films that have gotten me excited. Blasphemy, I know. I didn't even see The Desolation of Smaug. Smaug. But I'm not going to miss this one, and you don't want to miss this next segment, so stay right where you are. It is the Graylin Report with the Hanks Brothers. I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Hunkered down in the bunker because we're afraid that giant kaiju are going to attack us here.
Gojira!
That's right. You know, I wanted to get some sort of a Godzilla-themed question in on the program, because we're going to do a giveaway tonight, and for all the fantastic folks out there in the chat room, you get to participate in this. Because the first person who can get this question correct, let me tell you what you're going to get here. Now, it ain't no big secret that... Boy, that was kind of funny. Ain't no big secret.
Ain't no gotta bet. Ain't nobody got time for that.
I work as a... As a matter of fact, I should actually just take a copy here and just look in here.
Are you about to reveal to your listenership that you work at the Waffle House?
Well, I think I have too many teeth for that. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, that's a terrible joke, by the way, but I should explain what I mean by that. I was sitting in the sushi restaurant. Since we're talking about Japanese and all this, you know, and King Kong, or we're going to be talking about King Kong here in a moment.
No need for explanation. Just go for it, man.
Yeah, okay.
Just let him know.
I'm sitting there in the sushi restaurant Friday night. And I went by myself, but there were a lot of people in there, and we were all talking and just hanging out and having a fun time. And there was this adorable little 4-year-old girl who was sitting behind me at one of the hibachi grills. And the chef there is talking with her and everything, and she's just saying all the cute things that a little 4-year-old, you know, would say. And at one point, she tells him how many teeth she has. And the chef, and it's so funny because it was one of those frightening moments where, for whatever reason, all the talk in the restaurant just kind of died down naturally, and you could just, you know, all of a sudden hear the sushi chef's voice, or the hibachi chef's voice, as he says, "Wow, you've got almost enough teeth to work at the Waffle House." And the chef over here at the sushi bar where I was sitting, you know, he's this older Japanese guy, he just cracks up laughing. And it was slightly awkward, but, you know, also, I guess, admittedly... hilarious. So I'm looking over here on the masthead. Let's see. Yeah, sure enough there. I'm listed as a columnist now, although I'm actually a consulting editor just as well. But yes, I'm holding the latest edition, the July-August edition of Fate magazine here in my hands, and it features my good pal Robert Schock there on the front at Göbekli Tepe, and my good old buddy Phyllis up there at Fate magazine up at the Fate Farm. She has sent me along several copies of this. Now, I hate to say this, folks, but I am not... My column is not featured in this issue. We actually launched Robert Schock's new column in this one. But I'm going to be picking up the, I guess, the legacy of John Keel, because he had a column in Fate for years that was called Beyond the Known. And Phyllis approached me about picking up that column, but we're going to call it Beyond the Known, too.
Beyond the Gnome?
Gnome, yeah, like with a little red pointed hat.
Huh.
No, Beyond the Known. And
David the Gnome,
yeah,
beyond
David the Known. Yes, I'm going to be doing a column in Fate magazine, so I'm already listed here on the masthead as a columnist, and I promise that by the next issue you're going to have a column from yours truly in each edition of Fate magazine. But I'd like to go ahead and get these things out there to the public. Fate was kind enough to send along a bunch of copies, and so we're going to ask a quick question, and whoever here in the chat room gets this correct is going to get a free copy of the latest issue of Fate magazine featuring Robert Schock. There's going to be some other cool stuff in here, too. I don't know if we've ever done a giveaway on this program, but, you know, I mean, I'm sitting here with this stack of Fate magazines. We didn't really plan this, and I just kind of thought, you know, I think this would be a cool thing to do. Monsters on the Beach. Listen to that. Man, that's, like, totally, like, in line with the kind of stuff we're talking about here. A Monstrous Lake in Vermont.
Monster Vacation.
Giants and little people. Look at all the strange... Bless you, Caleb.
Sorry.
Look at all the strange... Here, look at this. I see by the papers. Let me just read some of the headlines here, because folks at home don't want to miss this. Addicted to Oreo cookies.
Oh, man, I've been there.
Sonny Bono haunts Cher.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Magic Restroom Cafe now open. Yeah.
Just, I hope they just... There's lots of hand sanitizer around.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking, too. Yeah, so anyway... So take home a copy of this. We're going to mail it to you direct from the bunker if you get this question right. Now, we were talking about Godzilla in the last segment, and there was a great film, because in the chat room I noticed people were talking about Godzilla needs a rematch with the Sasquatch. And really, I think what you guys meant to say there is that, you know, King Kong and Godzilla needed a rematch. Because I think the closest thing to a Sasquatch and Godzilla battling one another was the actual matchup between King Kong and Godzilla. There was a film made about this. I'm sure some of you out there have seen it. It was filmed in 1962. But now, here's the thing. Initially, when they were tossing around concepts about who King Kong was going to fight, it wasn't our favorite great big lizard-like Kaiju who was on the table. So the first person there, Caleb, in the chat room that answers correctly, and you know correctly who this was, right? You know who the object of the question was, right?
I do.
Okay, whoever in the chat room can tell us first who originally King Kong was supposed to fight. It wasn't Godzilla. Who originally was King Kong supposed to fight? Whoever gets that answer correct, what we're going to do is we're going to have Caleb look out for that, and then you can send along your information to him via a private message. But we got to find someone who can get that answer first.
Ladies and gentlemen, start your search engine.
That's right. Yeah, it's kind of hard to do trivia these days because anybody can just jump online. So really, it's just a matter of how quick you are on the draw.
Exactly.
In the meantime, we're going to go right on the news. You know, we were talking about the horrors of war. And just before we took the air tonight, well, great. It looks like it's going to be one of those wonderful moments where my page isn't loading properly. But I can go ahead and tell you essentially what's going on here while I hope and pray that this thing loads. It's not paranormal news. Well, it might be kind of paranormal if you think about it in a way. Parapolitical. Because right now, apparently, there is word that there is, all kidding aside, a possible actual plan for the withdrawal of all troops from Afghanistan. This is amazing because the page just loaded in front of me and then it just went blank again. This is my really kick-ass broadcast machine over here, folks. Very high-tech down here in the Greyland Bunker. In fact, we're actually from the future. Oh, look, that was almost the right answer. Avid Dabbler says Chuck Norris. Yes, it was going to be King Kong versus Chuck Norris.
But they knew Chuck Norris would kill King Kong.
Yeah, and they just didn't want King Kong to lose, and so, yeah, that couldn't happen. Yeah, try again there.
If anybody actually saw video footage of, like, what the bunker is, it just looks like... It's kind of like the Ninja Turtles lair
actually,
in the first Ninja Turtle movie.
Avid Dabbler there in the chat room. Oh, boom, look there. Henrik the Odd just got it.
You win.
All right. Henrik, congratulations. What you're going to need to do is just send a quick message to Caleb there, a private message, with a way that we can contact you or a way that you can get your mailing address to us, and we will send along a complimentary free issue of this month's Fate magazine with Robert Schock and Göbekli Tepe on the front there. And, of course, starting next, maybe I should do a column on Godzilla since we're talking about this so much. Now, of course, yeah. Oh, look at that. Wow. Adam was right behind him. Very close. Very close. That was so close, I don't know. I might have to give it to both of them because while Henrik got it right, Adam was more specific. And what that was specifically that King Kong initially was really going to battle was a giant Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah, that would have been really weird.
Yeah, but you know why that was the case, right?
No.
They actually ended up doing a Kaiju film about Frankenstein, where Frankenstein, like, the idea was that Frankenstein, like, would keep growing unhindered, you know, or something like that.
If, oh, weird.
Yeah, and so essentially what happens is he actually grows to giant proportions, and he does actually fight giant monsters and stuff, and so then that...
There's another great answer in the chat room. She said, Nikki says, I believe technically it was Frankenstein's monster.
Oh!
Look at you.
yeah, technical sense. You see, that's the funny thing. I have to
say...
Do
you have three to give away?
I got a whole stack of them over here. Look at this.
It's only fair.
Oh, man, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. Okay, yeah, because she technically is right. So, okay, Adam was more specific than Henrik. Henrik got it right. He said Frankenstein. We all knew what he meant
and
when he said Frankenstein.
First.
Yeah, he got it right. But Adam said a giant Frankenstein. It'd have to be giant to be able to fight King Kong. And then, yeah, Nikki was right. It actually technically was Frankenstein's monster. So, okay, all three of them get it. The only problem is Nikki's all the way down there in hot Australia. So she may have to.
I'll pitch in for the stands.
Well, yeah. Well, since the other two are runners up, they may have to settle for E issues. but either way, yeah, we're going to give one to all three of those guys. Okay, Caleb, get their information for me. Now that said, I do have this story finally open now. Before we get back to our serious discussion of how Frankenstein's monster would become giant and large enough to fight King Kong, the Obama administration did tell Afghanistan today that for the first time it has started planning, possibly, the withdrawal of all U.S. troops by the end of the year if no security agreement is signed. Statements by the White House Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel have showed that President Barack Obama's impatience with Afghanistan President Hamid Karzai's refusal to sign the agreement that would keep several thousand American troops in the country after combat operations conclude this year. So it's interesting because it doesn't seem to be exactly what people, I think, had hoped for or had expected. This all has to do with whether or not Karzai will sign this security agreement. But apparently in a phone call with Karzai on Tuesday, well, listen to me, with Karzai on Tuesday, to discuss the upcoming elections for a new Afghan leader, Obama made clear that the time was running out to properly plan for keeping any U.S. forces in the country. So if that expires, then apparently we are now planning potentially for the actual removal of troops from Afghanistan.
It's about time.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, that was something that I believe our president campaigned on. But I'm not going to get off into the realm of politics on that. You know, if people want to hear that kind of stuff, they can tune into Middle Theory. Right now we're going to talk about, you know, this is the program that brings you the gold. And speaking of, get this. This is pretty wild. A couple in California, they were lucky enough not to find Fukushima radiation or even Godzilla just yet. But what they did manage to find was about a $10 million pot of gold in their backyard. I kid you not. And there wasn't even a rainbow.
There was a trail of leprechaun turds, though.
Yeah, right. Get this. Okay, they were walking their dog, and the couple stumbled upon a, get this, about a little over 1,400 gold coins from the mid-19th century that were buried in 8 cans in the shade of a tree on their property in the state's famous gold country. This is incredible because when you hear about people actually taking money and putting it in coffee cans and burying it in their backyard.
But when that happens, I could be wrong, doesn't it belong to the state?
That's a good question. That's a really good question.
I don't know, because I think I heard a similar story recently, and the people that found it were not able to keep the money, and the state, like, collected all of it. I don't know what that was, and maybe it's different laws state by state, but...
Well, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I think we reported on a story a while back where there had been a large amount of money, and see, the headlines read that the money, you know, some, you know, huge amount of I'm trying to remember what era that hoard had actually dated back to, but... the story was that it had been confiscated by government, when in truth, yeah. Oh, I know what it was. It was money that had actually, I think, been stolen. And it had been stolen by a family member, like the grandfather of the individuals who recovered it. And then the Federal Reserve, I think, claimed it once it appeared again. Something like that. But so this pot of gold, this lucky pot of gold, was dubbed the Saddle Ridge Hoard and is believed to be one of the greatest buried treasures ever unearthed in the United States, according to numismatists at the journal Coin Update. You know what a numismatist is, Caleb?
That is what the step-down job from a receptionist.
That's right, yeah. Numismatist. Yeah, this is a person. Actually, I've known a few in my day, people who specialize in the dealing of coins, because there's quite a market with regard to coins, you know, especially coin collecting. You know, in certain circles, things like wheat pennies will actually sell for more than, a cent. Which is funny because, you know, a penny, all things considered, costs more than a cent to even make. So I'm wondering how long before pennies are finally removed from currency. Because, you know, when you've got currency out there that actually costs more to make than its own worth, that presents a little bit of a problem, doesn't it? Now, the Professional Coin Grading Service, which certified, don't worry, folks, no, this isn't going to end up being an infomercial that tells you why you need to buy gold. I'm going to go ahead and set off that. There's been enough fear with all this talk about Frankensteins and Sasquatches and Gargantuas Godzilla. God, I just had this horrible image in my mind of what if, like, Godzilla became even more horrible and it became Goblinzilla. Then we could have him at the Necrogoblicon.
Green Goblicon.
Gobzilla. That's the next step up. Gobzilla. I'm just Gobzilla fights the giant claw crab.
I would love that so much.
Gobzilla fights the giant, the giant new hamster. I can't even talk. It's just all
new,
giant monsters.
New Hamsterdam.
Yeah, Hamsterdam. Yeah, okay. Gobzilla versus the Rhode Island Moonstone Oyster. The giant Moonstone Oyster. It's like he gets his foot stuck
in
it.
Can you imagine how boring that movie would be? It's like he's just the oyster's just in a shell and Godzilla just beating it for 2.5 hours.
Yeah, it's like the shell won't open, but then Godzilla, like, he starts to walk away and the thing flies open and catches his foot or catches his tail.
He finally breaks it open in the last 30 minutes of the movie, or just him slowly eating.
I think I would love to see, yeah. He's having like a raw oyster, like, you know, dinner. You need to make an animated film, Godzilla versus the giant Rhode Island Moonstone Oyster.
I could do that.
I think that would be the most hilarious thing in the world.
And it's going to be a 2-hour long movie.
It's just Godzilla for 2 hours. Ah!
Not even really making any noise. He's just kind of wearing himself out.
It's like, really? It's like, really? You mean you put so much effort into that that you let the giant moonstone oyster win?
Somebody said... Wow! Somebody said Hadelzilla.
Hadelzilla. Godzilla versus the Hadel. Godzilla versus the giant Hadel. That's the one that we need right there. You know, I tell you, though, the theme in this new one is really looking... I mean, I'm telling you, like, I've got a quick little audio soundbite here from the promotional trailer. Just, you know, just a little bit to give you an idea of the feel that they're going for here. It's pretty
creepy.
You're
hiding something out there. And it is going to send us back to the Stone Age.
It's the McRib. It's back.
That's right. It's returned from the grave again and
Zombie
again.
Burger.
That's right. Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, it's reconstituted meat, right? I mean, that really is.
I'm pretty sure everything... fast food is zombie burger.
It's pretty about as close as you're going to get to being an actual zombie. Well, sandwich. Not really a burger, but, you know.
Godzilla versus a fleet of Mogwai.
Yeah, exactly. We should give away another edition of Fate Magazine for who can come up with the best, but we'd have to judge. It'd have to be a contest. The best new adversary for Godzilla to have to battle on screen. That actually might be kind of cool. I'll tell you, if I get a really good one, I invite emails on this, info@graylianreport.com. We might have to give them another shot at getting a free Fate magazine here. Because I would like to, I know that some of the listenership, as twisted and hilarious as your sense of humor is, look, the Grimerica guys are there in the chat room, in plural, notice, Grimerica.
They're artificial intelligence now. It's Grimeric AI.
Oh, that's what it is. Great. I know that there's some hilarious in there. Some hilarious, gosh. Anyway, you know, obviously I'm saving all my proper speech patterns for my talk with George Norrie here in about six hours and 12 minutes. So, the brain of Morbius. There's a good one. Yeah, throughout the program, we're going to enjoy the competition as people continue to try and come up with hilarious things that Godzilla could be fighting. What about Godzilla versus a UFO? You know,
Didn't that happen? Well, there was like that. There was that one movie, like Monster Island or whatever, where there was like crap tons of all the monsters.
I think they send them to like a separate planet, like, you know, destroy all monsters. They gather up all the kaiju and they send them to a great big planet where they all fight each other. I know, Godzilla versus Mitt Romney, giant Mitt Romney. That'd kind of be like Godzilla versus Frankenstein, though, wouldn't
it? Somebody in the chat earlier said giant Boris Karloff. And I'm thinking, that would actually be really, really awesome for just like a kind of Bubba Hotep spin-off crazy movie.
Yeah, but then again, though, by the same token, that would essentially be, you know, Godzilla versus, well, Frankenstein.
Yeah, but still.
Which never happened, but, King Kong was going to fight him.
Just to have, like, some giant genetically engineered clone of Boris Karloff. I think that would be hysterical.
He'd probably see Godzilla and he'd run the other way. He'd be like, I ain't touching that with a 10-foot pole.
No, he would look at him and be like, I know what I have to do, and just kick crap out of him.
Yeah, that would be pretty hilarious. No, Caleb, what we need here is, oh, look here in the chat room,
Godzilla versus Steven Seagal.
Yeah, I think Godzilla versus a giant Bruce Campbell. That would be the battle to end all battles.
Honestly, that's probably the next Bruce Campbell movie.
Yeah, Godzilla versus Ash from Evil Dead.
Do you know that they're making Army of Darkness 2 with Bruce Campbell?
They should.
I'm very excited about this.
That's what they should be doing. That's what they should have done all along. And they should have him become giant with the big chainsaw hand, and they should have him fight Godzilla.
Of course. I mean, that's the only logical step.
Yeah. But, you know, he could fight a UFO, I guess, you know. And speaking of which, you know, it's kind of funny because, I mean, here this summer, we're going to have Godzilla released in about June. And around April, we can expect that there are probably going to be a lot of UFOs in the skies. But here's the funny thing. Unfortunately, the cat's already out of the bag about this, but dozens of volunteers have signed up for what is being discussed as being the biggest prank in history, aimed at causing an apocalypse in the media. And yet the media is already reporting on it, which means that they're already hip to it. No doubt, I'm sure a few people would still be fooled. Here's the plan, apparently. On an April evening this year, swarms of glowing spacecraft will begin a flight through our atmosphere and hover over locations around the world. The goal is maximum panic. Oh, that's always cool. Right?
Is this just like the biggest flash mob ever, world record attempt?
It's a drone flash mob. This is the idea. Pilots of eerie craft that will be observed on this April night won't be little gray men from Alpha Centauri, but they'll be drone aircraft. Dozens of volunteers around the world have already signed up for what they say may be the biggest prank in history. Well, let's see. The biggest one next to this one right here, War of the Worlds. I've got it on vinyl. I keep a copy of that on vinyl here in the bunker.
You can see it if you look through our Twitter pictures on the Graylian Twitter.
Oh, we do have one up there on the Graylian. Yeah. So, yeah, so what the plan is here that they're going to be using strips of LED lights, and they're going to attach these things to remote Hold on. There it is, right there in the chat room. JDB just called it Godzilla versus Cthulhu.
Oh, man.
Caleb, why don't you animate that one for us?
I already animate Cthulhu.
Versus Cloverfield, but not versus, I'm sorry, Cloverfield. That was a little different.
Godzilla versus the Hanks Brothers. I like where they're taking this.
Did somebody actually say that? Yeah. Oh, God, that'd be ridiculous.
It's like us just standing there crapping our pants while Godzilla comes to kill us.
Whoa!
Whoa!
So on a remote-controlled multi-rotor drone aircraft, they're going to wait until around 8 p.m. I think if it's April, they might need to wait a little later than that. You know, at least wait until good and after dark. And then they hope to start flying these LED-covered drones all over the place. Now, they spoke with the author of the Haynes UFO Investigations Manual, and he's a guy who's commented on UFOs for years. That's Nigel Watson. He said, quote, that the plans to cause a wave of UFO sightings would, quote, be, let's see, wait, now hold on, what did he actually say here? I've got a Yahoo News article about this. He is apparently the one that found the plans. He says the big UFO project was originally scheduled to run on April Fool's Day, but they changed it to the 5th of April so that it will not seem like an obvious prank. Anyone who has a multi-rotor drone or anything that can carry a strip of LED lights and hover is invited to join in this event. I wonder if it's actually going to happen now that Nigel Watson's ruined everybody's fun. I'm just kidding. No, he apparently blew the lid on this. But so according to him, the plan was to launch at 8 p.m. local time for maximum impact. That's when apparently their logic was that there would be more people out at around 8 p.m. rather than later. I don't know. I mean, if you did this over New York, you know, I mean, over the Empire State Building, well, first of all, you're going to get the FAA involved. But ideally, I mean, you're probably going to have a lot of people no matter what time you do. And if you did it on a weekend, what day of the week actually does April 5th fall on? Let's take a look here.
Because, I can do this.
Because if this is on a weekend, I mean, hell, you could do it at 3 o'clock in the morning. You're going to have a
April 5th?
Yeah, April 5th. That falls on a Saturday night.
Saturday.
So. That's right. That's going to be it. Oh, God, we're going to be on Dolfusky Island. We won't be able to see any UFOs.
It was the apocalypse on a Saturday night.
We won't be able to see anything from Dolfusky Island. That's not going to be fun at all. We're going to be on one of the most remote locations off the East Coast that night, yeah. You and I. And
I don't know. Maybe we'll get a drone or two over Savannah.
I know what I'll do. We could probably look across the harbor from Marshside Mamas, and we'd probably be able to see Tybee Island at least. Let's hope that there's a UFO landing at Tybee Island. Hell, with all the lights out there on that beach, they'd probably think it was a landing strip.
Godzilla versus Justin Bieber. I don't even know if Godzilla would enjoy eating Justin Bieber.
Yeah, well, yeah, because he'd obviously lose Bieber, that is. But,
No, I mean eating, because there's no fight.
Godzilla versus the Bebo. Except the thing is he kind of looks like God.
Bebo.
That's our new nickname for him.
Dude, he's a total Bebro now.
Bebro, yeah, exactly. Well, see, with that hair of his, he kind of has the big, you know, Frankenstein head already, so at least he resembles it. Didn't you like that Nitrograss poster I did, by the way, where I gave you the huge hair?
I did like that.
I thought you liked it. It actually looked cool. So anyway, it's going to be interesting if these UFOs get launched like they're talking about. And, oh man, look at this. Look, we're having so much fun that we've just blasted right through another break. We're going to have to take one here in just a moment. Before we do, I got one final story. You know, no, I'm going to save that. Because I do want to talk about, this is something I've almost sworn off on and refused to even mention on this program. But I think I am going to bring it up. And I also have an email that people who listen to my Sunday night program may have already heard. I'm thinking about getting to that here because it's very relevant to the discussion here. And it's something that I know we've got a very, very, very large listenership, much of which is different from the KGRA listenership. And I don't want my Graylian people to miss this. But I got this fabulous letter from one of the listeners recently who, unfortunately, only on conditions of anonymity, allowed me to discuss the nature of this email. And that's because I get a lot of messages from people in academia who are, you know, obviously, and I respect this, by virtue of their position as a researcher or as a professor, maybe at a college, they cannot go out and publicly state their interest in Fortean phenomena and the unexplained. Now, I, of course, have nothing to lose. I've been doing this for 10 years. I've become a lot more skeptical over the last 10 years. And I've put together, I think, a really comprehensive article about that very subject that you're going to be seeing at Mysterious Universe here in the next couple of days. So keep an eye out for that. But, I was talking with my buddy Greg Bishop last night, and he was talking about, you know, the ancient Greek think what was effectively referred to as the Puritanist attitude towards skepticism. And even in her media guide to skepticism over at Doubtful News, Sharon Hill references that, although she also says that the, you know, abstaining from drawing conclusions like the ancient Greek skeptics is not a popular attitude towards skepticism today. She says that that's not the same thing as the modern skeptic, but nonetheless, a good skeptic is not a denialist, and they don't just rule out the possible, okay? Now, I've become more skeptical, and obviously, it doesn't even take a bad skeptic to be able to look at this thing that Rick Dyer's been carrying around. Have you seen this? I've likened it to Fozzie Bear with a monkey face. And we do have an update, at very least, but I haven't said a whole lot about it because, honestly, I mean, the whole thing is so absurd, I don't think it needs to be justified with serious discussion. But I think I'm going to, now that he actually has appeared and there's a little bit of talk now about, I think, first of all, he was a no-show when he went out to Phoenix, and now he's appeared finally in Houston. And sadly, I am sad to say that there were hundreds, as reported in the media here about this, that apparently showed up for the debut of Dyer's alleged Sasquatch that he killed, which if anyone has looked at this thing, you know, I mean, I'm talking, you can look at the Patterson-Gimlin footage, and even Brian Dunning of Skeptoid, another skeptic that I do respect, although I have to say that I watched that entire program from Joe Rogan's podcast where he kind of did battle with Dunning. I was amazed at how many of the things that Dunning came on and tried to argue that he did not have either correct statements or what seemed to be a full correct comprehension of, that he nonetheless tried to present a skeptical argument for. I mean, for instance, where Joe's buddy comes on there and starts talking about how, what it was that Dunning jumps in there and tries to say essentially that someone came on there saying that there was something you could take that would essentially remove alcohol intoxication from your body, and you could drink all you want and not get drunk. And that, when I listened to it, did not seem to be what that guy was saying. That seemed to be what Dunning was interpreting, and I was a little amazed at this renowned skeptic, Brian Dunning. Again, some of his writing I've really enjoyed. He seems like an okay guy, and yet, by the same token, he seems so grossly off base with a lot of the interpretations that he was making.
What's the fun in drinking and not getting drunk?
What the guy actually said, based on my interpretation of what was being said on the episode, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners have seen this too, so I wonder if other people feel the same. This friend of Joe's that's a doctor was actually saying that there was a person who he had, what is it? Is it glutathione? I need to look it up, the technical name, but it's actually produced in our bodies. But the thing is that there aren't enough levels that are present naturally in the body so that when a person actually is consuming large quantities of alcohol, that it can offset the effects of the alcohol taken into the body, and hence intoxication occurs. But this doctor, what he said was that one of his patients apparently had been out drinking one night, and he came home and he was feeling really sick, and he took some of this supplement. And I don't know if supplement would be the proper terminology, but anyway, the substance, he actually took some of this. And what the doctor had said was that 30 minutes later he had felt better, and that the next day he went out drinking again and had a hard time actually getting intoxicated. He didn't seem to say that people could go out and drink all they want and not get drunk, but, you know, again, here I see Dunning just jumping up and down and saying he was just, you know, so angry that this guy had been making this claim. And even Joe says, brother, I don't think that's the claim he was making. So it's interesting because I do think that ideologically a lot of people jump on the skeptic bandwagon and they back up their ideological viewpoint, and sometimes they'll even do that in not in the absence of facts, but in the absence of a correct, non-biased interpretation of those facts. So anyway, I provided a little commentary about that over at Mysterious Universe. You'll see that here in a couple of days, but it doesn't even take a skeptic, good or, you know, what I would call a good skeptic, like myself, or even Joe Rogan. Joe held his own extremely well in that conversation with Brian Dunning, maybe better than Dunning did, in truth. He may not be the most eloquent speaker, but Joe's obviously a smart guy. I was thoroughly impressed with that, but by the same token, it doesn't take a good or a bad skeptic to be able to tell that what Rick Dyer's got over there, that he's calling Bigfoot, probably ain't really a Bigfoot, but I do want to talk about that just a little when we come back. And then we'll take a look at the academic side of the giant monster thing, since that seems to be the running theme tonight. There are people out there, maybe they aren't believers, but they're open-minded enough to ask these questions. They just can't come out and talk about it. But we're talking with you. It's the Grayling Report. We'll be back right after this.
Is the Grayling Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grayling Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
All right, Leroy Jenkins, let's do this. Welcome back to the program. Yeah, I'm cutting up a little bit. We're just having some fun tonight, and I'll tell you why, because I got to stay up all night. There's no point if you're going to go on coast to coast. There's no point in trying to go to and take a nap and sleeping, you know? It just ain't going to be good for you. You're either in it or you're not, and I'm in it for the long haul, so I'm going to be staying up all night. And then, get this, at 3 a.m. East Coast time, I will be appearing on the program immediately following no less venerable a guest than the Michio Kaku.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you tune in at 1 a.m. East Coast time, you're going to hear Michio Kaku discussing his new book. And then I follow Michio Kaku. I think even cooler than being on Coast to Coast is being on Coast to Coast after Michio Kaku.
It's pretty awesome.
It's pretty awesome. So for all of you night owls, or if you're like Nikki out there and you're on the other side of the world, so it'll probably be like, I don't know, Nikki, what time will it be at 3 a.m. East Coast time for you?
Summertime and the living's easy.
It'll be summertime and she'll be laying next to the pool listening to probably Coast to Coast AM.
While we're here in the bunker,
hiding from Godzilla,
freezing our nates.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to be in here hiding from the king of all monsters, like we always do. Speaking of the king of all monsters, there are some hilarious additions here in the chat room. I liked Caleb's a lot. Godzilla versus Ted Danson.
I think Ted has a fighting chance.
He probably would, man. Well, he's the boss, isn't he?
I think
no. That was that no. Was he was Tony Danza.
Cheers. I don't think Ted Danson's skull can be crushed.
What about Tony Danza versus Godzilla?
Tony would sing him love songs. Somebody said Grumpy Cat, and I just thought the Grumpy Cat would depress Godzilla.
Yeah, let's see here. We've also got, there's some funny stuff, and they aren't all matchups, but we've got Godzilla versus Ted Danson, Revenge of the Killer Godzillas, Godzilla versus Grumpy Cat. I think that one would be really good. The Godzilla Father, yeah. San Quentin Predators versus Godzilla. That was from
That's a good one.
Luke, God Almighty. Predators versus Godzilla.
And one that will tie that all together for our next topic.
Oh, I know. Rick Dyer versus Godzilla. He'll just kill it and take it on, you know, take it on tour.
The Stay Puft Man from Ghostbusters versus Godzilla.
Oh, that would be really awesome, yeah. And speaking of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, you know, it's with a heavy heart that we pay homage tonight, of course, to director and actor Harold Ramis.
The fall.
There's something very important I forgot to tell you.
What?
Don't cross the streams.
Why?
It would be bad.
It would be bad. And unfortunately, we had some pretty bad news this week. That's right. Harold Ramis, described recently by the New York Times as the alchemist of comedy, passed away at age 69. This was due to complications from vasculitis, which is a disease that he came down with years ago. Caleb, there are more than 15 varieties of this, and yet the official cause of vasculitis is still largely unknown. Now, even President Obama, speaking publicly about Ramis' passing, had made something of a reference, I think. People were talking about how he was quoting Caddyshack, but he also kind of in a roundabout way made a reference to the afterlife. And interestingly, this is, I mean, of all the things he was known for, you know, he wrote the screenplay for Groundhog Day, I believe, and we can consider that his magnum opus. But of all the things he was involved with, no, nothing, nothing out there are we hearing more about in relation to the passing of Harold Ramis than Ghostbusters. And Caleb showed me this really cool image that somebody had put up probably on Twitter that showed Ramis walking off into the ever after holding hands with Slimer. It really was quite touching, I have to say.
Yeah, I definitely almost cried looking at that.
Yeah, Harold Ramis holding hands with Slimer. And it, even as hilarious as that is, it's just incredible.
Yeah, it's really beautiful.
Yeah, the way that, you know, I mean, people are really kind of responding to it. And so even Obama had said, our thoughts and prayers are with Harold's wife, Erica, his children, his grandchildren, and all those who loved him, who quote his work with abandon, and who hope that he received total consciousness. That he received total... That's an interesting statement from our commander-in-chief.
From the Barack Ness monster.
He had said a few things in his life, you know, of course, in relation to the unexplained. And, you know, of course, Dan Aykroyd.
Dan Aykroyd's some next-level stuff sometimes.
Dan, I'd love to get him on here and interview him sometime. But, you know, Dan, of course, is very well known for his interest in the unexplained. But Harold Ramis was a little more of a skeptic. You know, he said, I used to be married to a woman who pursued every spiritual trend with tremendous passion and who dragged me along. He said, I don't believe in anything. I'd seen mediums. I'd seen readers. But he said, I do believe in things, or rather, I believe things happen that can't be explained. It's just that so many people seem intent on explaining them. Everyone has an answer for them, either aliens or things from the spirit world. So while being a skeptic, he did say that he believed that things did happen that remained unexplained. He was apparently pronounced dead on February 24th at his Chicago area home. He was best known for the directing of films that included National Lampoon's Vacation, Caddyshack, National Lampoon's Animal House, and, of course, Stripes. But as I've already mentioned, I think, you know, really, I mean, he's gotten more acclaim, especially with his passing, for his involvement with Ghostbusters. Vasculitis, which claimed his life, is an immune system disease that attacks the body's veins and arteries, restricts or stops the flow of blood to various parts of the body, and can also lead to internal bleeding, even aneurysm. So, you know, it's of course something we're all very sad about, and a lot of my friends who follow the unexplained also are you know, movie buffs, and God, who doesn't like Ghostbusters, you know?
Well, another thing too is they've been talking about doing Ghostbusters 3 for so long, and Bill Murray was pretty, you know, vehemently opposed to doing that, but I mean, I'm totally down with letting things die with dignity, not talking about Harold Ramis, but like the Ghostbusters franchise, but I don't know, I think it'd be interesting if Bill and Dan Aykroyd decided to do one in tribute to Harold. I think it'd be fun, man.
It would be interesting, you know, and I think, you know, people would probably try and say, oh, but after he's passed away, if they did anything that tried to incorporate Egon into all of it, you know, that would be tasteless. Actually, I don't think it would, because Harold Ramis, guys, he made his career off of comedy and humor, and I think that, you know, he enjoyed those kinds of things. You know, he had actually worked, I think, as a jokes editor for Playboy for a number of years, and he'd said that I'd never read an issue of Playboy before I went to work for him, and the day I left, I never looked at another issue of it. You know, but the actual job he had was, you know, people would send party jokes. They would receive submissions for party jokes through Playboy magazine. And Harold Ramis applied for the job of being the editor who basically would take those jokes that were received, and he would clean them up, and he would make them, you know, presentable for the magazine. And so he did that, and then I think he was actually promoted eventually to the title of associate editor, if I remember correctly. But isn't it incredible, all the stuff that I know about Harold Ramis? So, but you know, I mean, I think like a lot of us, when you have, you know, someone who's such an icon, not necessarily in the field of the unexplained, but in, you know, cinema and in script writing and you know, film directing and things like that, he'll always be connected with the unexplained because of Ghostbusters. But, you know,
And Ghostbusters, I mean, talk about just an all-around entertaining, great film that stands the test of time. And speaking of which, and showing how nerdy and also tight-knit and awesome my friends are.
Or just nerdy, but...
A group of us got together just a couple months ago and did Ghostbusters night. We do it every single year, and we all got together, about 12 of us, and just watched it and enjoyed the spectacle that it is. And I also just... I love Rick Moranis in that movie, man.
He is hilarious.
Rick has not done any acting or anything for years now because his wife passed away, and he just decided he wanted to be a dad more than anything. But
I heard part of that. I think that you told me about the interview with him on the Nerdist.
Yeah, Nerdist podcast, and it was great to hear from the guy again.
I want to go to a Ghostbusters night. Is this what you guys do while I'm out at night? What are you going to do next time? Lie to me and kiss my butt?
But I'm a voter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, obviously I'm the Murray in this equation. Jeez, but, well, oh, goodness. Okay, so anyway, getting back to, yes, first getting back to the chat room, there are some great matchups here between Godzilla. For instance, Godzilla versus Godzilla. Godzilla versus Dr. Satan from House of a Thousand Corpses. Godzilla versus Global Warming.
That was a really good idea, as though it's a documentary about the dilapidating habitat of Godzilla. That is awesome.
Godzilla versus the giant Gary Coleman.
Yeah.
Godzilla, let's see here, versus the minstrel female Godzilla.
Maybe Godzilla just is the minstrel female Godzilla.
That was very similar to the one that Nikki proposed, Godzilla versus angry Mrs. Godzilla. He stayed out too late. Yeah.
Godzilla, were you out again destroying cities without me?
Some of this is just absurd. Bill Cosby feeding Jell-O pudding to Godzilla.
Yeah, I got in on that one, too.
Godzilla dream oil painting. Oh, that was you.
What? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so anyway.
That was me.
There's a lot of good ones in here in the chat room. Boy, these people are just going wild with all this. And then, here's a good one. Here's one that Mike suggests. Godzilla versus the Ancient Alien Cruise.
Mike, I'm going to go ahead and say that would be terrifying.
Yeah, exactly. I think, unfortunately, I'm going to have to say I don't want Godzilla to get anywhere near a cruise ship that I'm on. Now, if people in the chat room wanted to go on the Ancient Alien Cruise, that's fine. If people who are out there listening, that's cool, too. Godzilla
versus the mullet.
Godzilla versus the mullet.
The proverbial mullet.
Yeah.
Only one person can destroy this haircut.
Caleb, but they're talking about Mothra now in there, you know? And this is cool because there's a bit of a 14 tie-in with all that just as well.
Mothra's the jam.
Well, Mothman, you know? And that's the funny thing is Tyler Pittman and I were talking yesterday on the phone, and we were saying that we need to film a spoof where it's a couple of guys, you know? Because, I mean, I just love these these TV shows that have to do with, like, you know, finding Bigfoot and all this stuff. I've compared finding Bigfoot to the modern American snipe hunt. Literally, think about it. But we've talked about this.
Tonight on Rainbow Chasers.
I mean, you might at least find a pot of gold. But, I mean, if you know what snipe hunting is, and I'm not talking about the actual shorebird, which is where the name for this is derived, but a snipe hunt is essentially a nonsensical attempt to go hunting something that doesn't exist. And more importantly, to fool somebody. You know where I learned about snipe hunting, Caleb?
No.
I'd actually never heard of this, but this is hilarious. I was probably in my late teens or early 20s, and no less than Joshua P. Warren and I were hanging out one night, drinking a little whiskey together, about a decade ago. This just tells you a little bit about my relationship with Joshua P. Warren. Joshua Warren and I are out there, and he says, "Oh, wait, Micah, you've never gone on a snipe hunt? Oh, God." And so he runs and he gets a pillowcase and he takes me outside, and I knew it was all a big joke, but I mean, when Josh decides to take you and drag you out into the forest in the middle of the night, it's usually entertaining. And so I grab the pillowcase and we go out there and he explains what's going on and he says, "Now, you know, it's very hard to really describe what a snipe looks like, but you have to make a certain kind of a call. You have to hold the pillowcase close to the ground and hold it open in a certain way. And if you're lucky, the snipe will come. And if you're good at calling it, it will come and it will jump into the sack and then you've captured your snipe." And I'm like, it's going to help me immensely, Josh, if I know what to look like. I mean, is this thing like a Sasquatch or like a Mogwai or something? And he says, "Well, you know, snipe's kind of like a, you know, looks kind of like a," he never really described it, but that's the whole hilarious thing about all this. And so then John Anderson, who I worked in with radio and who's done some announcing here on this program, John Anderson and I said we should just do a book together called A Southerner's Guide to Snipe Hunting, an illustrated guide. And this is what it is. It's a fool's game where you take people out there into the woods and you let them bang sticks together and make calls and try and summon the snipe. Now, when you watch Finding Bigfoot, what are they out there doing? They're out there doing their Bigfoot call. They're banging sticks together, knocking rocks on trees.
They're looking for a hairier snipe than usual.
But the reason it's called snipe hunting is because, like you pointed out to me when we were talking about this, Kelby, a snipe is actually a shorebird. And it is renowned among game hunters, or game hunters actually would probably be like, you know, like Killer Sasquatch and Godzilla. In other words, monsters that hunt hunters. But wing shooters describe the snipe as being a notoriously difficult game bird to shoot, and that's what the reason for the name snipe hunt is, because it's next to impossible to do. So they say, let's go ahead and just make it impossible, and hence the game of snipe hunting. But Bigfoot hunting today is like a modern equivalent of snipe hunting. All right? Exactly. Thanks to, and I don't want to just be too critical of finding Bigfoot. You know, I've spoken at least once to Matt Moneymaker on the telephone, and, you know, I think these people are sincere in what they're trying to do. I just don't know if it's really doing the best at really trying to get to the bottom of the whole Bigfoot question.
Well, it's entertainment, bottom line. I mean, if you're going to be doing, like, super serious research, there's usually not a script involved. So.
Yeah, well, and by the way, I think Nikki just named it Godzilla versus Dergopal.
Yeah, I know. I was going to bring that one up. That's awesome.
That is the best, yes. Godzilla versus the giant, glowing, flying jellyfish. That is exactly what we need. Because, see, you know, while Godzilla is able to use, like, his radiation breath and everything, Dergopal can actually, you know, she can, like, zap you with, like, lightning from her tentacles, you know. She would be an awesome
adversary.
I can
imagine. I just, if they actually did that straight up, this just giant, crazy, flying jellyfish, that would look so rad.
Yeah, seriously, like, Godzilla's out there stomping around and everything, and here this thing comes, like, floating along, and it starts zapping him with electricity. I think it'd be really horrific.
Oh, my God. You actually made that.
Yeah. You never listened to Middle Theory?
I've never heard.
Dergopal hangs out with us quite a bit on Middle Theory. Yeah, Dergopal's like a mainstay, in fact.
All hallowed and praised be Dergopal, Lord of the Low-Low-Lows.
That's right. Even Alex Jones knows about Dergopal.
Pentagon's like, how do we get the jellyfish into total war? Dance around and prance.
There you go, man. So. So now you know. Oh, look here. Surely the Klingologist in the chat room is not John Wilson. I know that for a fact. Couldn't be. But when it comes to the snipe hunt and the Bigfoot thing, obviously, we had to get around to talking about Rick Dyer. I've tried not to do this, folks, and yet here we are. Now, I've actually, you know, in addition to not wanting to justify that silliness with any serious conversation, you know, Rick Dyer, we all know that he was involved with another hoax a few years ago. He and Matt Whitten, and that was a very interesting situation because I think I could probably tell you this. You know, I had a friend who called me that day when that whole debacle was going on. I remember I had the news on. I remember in this instance it happened to be Fox News because I remember Shep Smith coming back on and saying, okay, God, now let's just get us some real news here. But they cut away and they actually went to this live press conference where Tom Biscardi, who, you know, Caleb, you and I have met him and had breakfast with him before.
Yep.
I've not talked with Tom in years. And, of course, he claimed that he'd been spoofed like everybody else and all that. But, I mean, unfortunately, if it sounds like it's too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. You know, anyway, I won't get off on that subject, but
they were just talking about in the chat room of finding Bigfoot found Bigfoot. And I was just saying, finding Bigfoot finds Bigfoot. Show ends.
What there needs to be is reality TV show where there are Bigfoot creatures out there in the woods that are trying to evade capture. And the team of camera people follow the Bigfoot as they are, like, you know, calling back and they're, like, walking out in front of, like, thermal traps and stuff.
Yeah, it's Bigfoot Brother After Dark. Have you ever seen that show?
No.
It's a reality show where basically they have cameras all around a house and people are, like, talking to this Zoltar machine, but I think that would be a fun thing. Is you're out in the woods, there's cameras all over the trees, and people just watch as people in Bigfoot costumes just destroy these people.
We've got a great idea here, I think. Yeah, I mean, this may sound like absurd conversation, but is any of it really any less absurd than what is going on out here with this whole thing? And that's the whole situation with Rick Dyer. Again, go back a few years, he'd been involved with a hoax years ago. And I remember the day that was being broadcast on CNN and Fox. I mean, all the news stations actually cut away to this press release. Apparently, people thought that it was newsworthy. Enough people out there believed. Heck, Brian Dunning, we were talking about in the last segment, he actually had said on Joe Rogan's podcast that within the last 5 years, he had actually been a believer in the Patterson-Gimlin footage. He had actually thought just as recently as a few years ago that might have been real. You know, I mean, that's very interesting. I've always been on the fence on that. It looks really good, and I think that's what Dunning was trying to say. A lot of us admit it looks really good, but in likelihood, I mean, how likely can it really be that that's a Bigfoot? Maybe it is. I've talked with a few people about that, but there's some dirt about the Gimlin film, the Patterson film. Gimlin's still alive, of course. There are people... I don't know which one you're laughing at, but there's some hilarious...
Dude, I just have to say this on the air. A town of Bigfoots find a John Lithgow.
There you go.
That one was avid. That is hysterical.
That's
well done.
Yep, that's our buddy Luke in Australia right there. Oh, boy. So, I mean, no, seriously, it is all absurd. It is all absurd. And yet there are serious repercussions that can come into question with all this. Like, for instance...
I cannot believe that this is getting so much attention. Well, this mummified ex-monster from the time machine.
Well, I'll tell you this, man. Nick Redfern wrote the book The Monster Files. And I'll tell you this. Government does get interested in things like this from time to time. And here's a quick example. You know, I'm going to, again, on terms of anonymity, I've got an old buddy from the Air Force. I wasn't in the Air Force. He was. But he called me the day that press release was going on, the first time around that Rick Dyer and Matt Whitten showed up claiming they had a Bigfoot body. Isn't that sad that he's doing it again and yet it's still in the news? I can literally sit here on the microphone and say the first time he did it, and yet I'm looking at news stories that are talking about this one as though they're, well, you never know, this one might be real.
What a crappy legacy, though. Oh. I'm that loser that showed up in the news multiple times for faking Bigfoot.
Exactly. I mean, crap. So this Air Force buddy of mine calls me up, and Caleb, I don't know, you might know this story, but he calls me that day, and he sent me an email first, and Nick Redfern and I were actually talking online back and forth watching the press release, and I'd asked him, I said, Nick, what do you think? I was, at that point, you know, a little concerned. I had actually called Tom Biscardi and talked to him on the telephone earlier that day, and he had maintained that the thing was real on the telephone, but something about the whole situation, I mean, I'm sorry, I hate to say this, but I mean, the truth of the matter is it doesn't take a rocket scientist, you know. It was obvious, even at that point, that this thing was likely to be a fake. And what really disheartened me was how many serious researchers were looking at it and hopefully wishing that there might be something to it. So I'm watching the press release, and I messaged Nick Redfern. I said, I don't know, Nick, you know, what do you think? And he says, well, the guys at least seem credible, but, you know, I think there was a lot of question about the photos of the thing with the tongue out of its mouth and all that, you know. And so we were talking. And then this other friend of mine emails me. He says, Michael, would you give me a call? I need to talk to you. And he basically tells me that he'd said, you know, I have, you know, some friends who contacted me from a government agency, a three-letter agency. And what he told me is that they were investigating this. And I said, you know, to my friend, I said, they don't really think that this thing could be a real Bigfoot. And he said, not at all. But what is going on is that they are promoting it as though it is, and they're also selling tickets to go on monster hunts with them. And basically the bottom line was this. If they were engaging in interstate commerce and they were using fraudulent means to promote that, there was the potential for them actually breaking federal laws. And so they were being potentially investigated, was what this friend had told me, is that there was a good, strong possibility that these guys might, you know, that anyone who would go out there and perpetrate a hoax like that and seek to profit from it could get in trouble for doing so. So... you know, that's something, I guess, that should be taken into consideration in situations like this. You know, that one, of course, was pretty obviously a hoax. I would say this one is even more obviously a hoax because there's not the ambiguity of the thing being trapped under ice. And yet people are still out there talking about it. You know, we'll talk about it just briefly when we come back, and then maybe I'll take things in a slightly different direction because a few of us probably remember that there was something a little more interesting that popped up back several decades ago. Under ice and then disappeared and then allegedly reappeared. We'll get into all of that when we come back here on the Gray Alien Report. Stay with us. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylin Report. Welcome back. As we're talking about giant monsters and, well, unfortunately, giant hoaxes as well here on the program. There have been a lot of attempts at trying to put the Bigfoot conversation on ice with a little bit of creative hoaxing over the years. The first attempt at doing this was back in the 1960s. This is a fascinating story, actually. I think this one goes all the way back to around, maybe it was around 1968. But the story had been that there was a promoter, Frank Hansen, and there was allegedly a monster that had either been killed in Minnesota or captured in Siberia, and it was put under ice. And this became known as the Minnesota Iceman. This is sort of the origin of the legend, and we'll come back around and we'll talk about that here in a moment. But first, obviously, with the idea of putting a Bigfoot-like creature under ice, I think that that was probably the origin of the idea for the last go-around with Bigfoot, you know, body frozen in ice. Why put a body in ice? What's the benefit of doing that? Well, of course, obviously, if you've got a body that is encased in ice, it obscures certain details and makes it more difficult to discern the legitimacy of the origin of the creature supposedly encased within. And if the attempt here is to try and pass this off as being something that is real, then you've obscured people who examine it from being able to get really close enough to really tell what's going on.
Would you freeze? Would you do the cryonics? Would you freeze your head?
I don't know. That's beyond the scope of this conversation. I'd have to think about it. But then again, you know, if my head was frozen, I'd have a lot of time to do that.
I'm going
to
do that, and I'm going to come out, and I'm going to be all like Arnie in that Batman movie, and he's going to be like, "Yeah, you're about to be really, really killed." Yeah,
that's right. So, now this latest attempt at hoaxing the Bigfoot body. The Bigfoot is not on ice, and I have to say that I don't know that that's going to be helpful, because if you look at this thing, again, I'm serious. I mean, the best description I can give is it looks like Fozzie Bear with a monkey face laying there, and the thing looks sewed together, and there are claims that the Bigfoot body, after it was killed, regenerated and, like, healed itself.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, they're saying...
I want a Bigfoot on the rocks.
They're saying... Yeah, exactly. They're saying the most absurd stuff about this thing. And apparently, after being a no-show in Phoenix, the thing finally went on display and drew hundreds in its debut there in Houston. So the story goes that this dubious display drew about 800 people to Trader's Village in northwest Harris County on Sunday during the first and unexpected Houston stop of the traveling spectacle. Rick Dyer told the press, "We got here a day early and we just wanted to show as many people as possible." He calls himself, of course, a master tracker, and claims he killed this creature back in 2012. The people of all ages shelled out money to enter his trailer to look into the 9-foot case that holds the specimen, which he's calling Hank. Some were sold, others not so much. Mario Lopez said, "I'm not convinced after taking a look at it with his wife Julie and their 3 children. I believe the Roger Patterson footage is authentic," he says, "because you can see the muscles and everything on there, but this one was kind of different." But he did mention that after the autopsy, the body kind of changes. So they claim that the thing has undergone an autopsy. I did not know that. Wendy Hernandez was so convinced of what she saw that she bought a T-shirt and had Dyer sign it. She says, "It's amazing. When you go inside, you feel different. I'd never seen anything like this before."
Did you say Mario Lopez?
He was the last person, yeah.
Mario Lopez, like Saved by the Bell Mario Lopez.
I'm sure it's a different one. Now, Dyer claims to have killed Hank, named after an investor, outside of San Antonio in 2012. Hank will be on display Monday at the Mason Park Alamo Draft House and Tuesday at the Vintage Park location. Both shows are sold out. I don't know, Caleb, you think it's real?
Of course.
You buy it, huh?
Hell no.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about this is that... In addition to the claim, and here's actually what Dyer, as I understand, has said. He claims that apparently this thing was killed right outside of San Antonio. And rather interestingly, there was actually, get this, there was a 911 dispatch call that had been reported in the area. It's since then been released to the public. But this 911 call had been an audio recording between a dispatcher and what is believed to be, they described themselves as a homeless couple. The recording had been made on November 30th, I believe, of 2012. And what they claimed was they had seen a large something consuming the carcass of a deer. Now, since Dyer claims that the kill that he made, what he calls Hank, took place there near San Antonio, people have tried to say that, well, it's something tied in with the hoax. But as I understand, I believe that Dyer had claimed that he had killed Hank. If I'm correct on this, I believe it was September of 2012, whereas this audio came out November 30th. And interestingly, I think there's one point, and I'm not trying to make a case for the legitimacy of this, and I know, again, you know, a hardline skeptic might tell you, well, then don't talk about it because that's doing more harm than good. But I do want to point out that if indeed this was released by 911 dispatch to the public there in the San Antonio area, it seems to me that we should at least consider one element here, and that is that the people who made the call, who were purportedly homeless individuals, a 63-year-old man and his wife who were living in a tent near an intersection, they claimed that they saw this thing. But when they made this call, if this was a legitimate call made to a 911 dispatch, and there have been some news agencies in the area that reported on this, KENS5, I think, was one of them, they had actually talked about the fact that the audio had apparently actually been taken from dispatch and then was released to the public. But when the call was made by the people who allegedly made it, would they have known that this would be released into the public? That's a question I have. Did they know, or would they have had any knowledge that this would have been released and thereby the motive for hoaxing it be more apparent? Because, I mean, the thing is if you wanted to hoax a 911 call and release that to the public and then claim it was a 911 dispatch call, that's one thing. If you were wanting to hoax maybe the dispatch officers themselves, you could call and you could make a funny story up. But, you know, there's no guarantee that that's going to be made public. Now, what would be the whole issue with it being made public at all? Well, people have tried to make an association between Dyer's claims about killing Bigfoot in San Antonio and this 911 call. Because apparently what he claims is that he had been following reports from people who said that they were seeing this thing in this area. We have a little of the audio here. This is the gist of what happened, allegedly, on November 30th from the actual 911 call that involved two homeless people, very frightened, and purportedly having seen a Bigfoot.
It was a critter, but it smelled real bad. I'm a homeless female. I live right in the middle of the woods, around 151, just north of Claiborne. 1604 was the lightest. Uh-huh. This big thing was 75 feet away from me, smells awful, devoured a whole deer carcass, and then took off and, like, screamed, screeched, and took off across the street. And I know you guys are going to think I'm crazy, but I'm dead serious. There was something very big, a lot bigger than me, out here. So, just thought somebody should know. I really don't know what you can do about it.
How long ago did this happen?
This is, immediately, like,
Now, the audio goes on for about 8 minutes.
And the whole time, John Goodman's thinking, I can't even stop for a snack on the way home from a bar without the cops calling.
Yeah, right.
Cops being called.
Again, it's mildly compelling. In likelihood, it's a hoax. The question is, as many people have tried to say, I wonder if this is truly connected with Rick Dyer's claims, or if this alleged 911 call, which again, I mean, as far as we know, the call was actually made to 911 dispatch, but we cannot assert the veracity of the claims being made by the caller. And one important point to note here is that the callers had called. It was raining that night, November 30th, and the dispatcher asked if they could send an officer out, and they said, well, yeah, but we're not going out because, I mean, we're up here in a tent and this thing really scared us. The officer had said that when he went near the intersection where the people said that they lived close to, they were actually camping in the forest nearby. He couldn't see a tent. Now, that doesn't necessarily remove the possibility that there was a tent, that two homeless people were camping in it, and that he didn't just see them. You know, another good question, though, of course, might be that if these people were homeless, you know, how did they have access to a phone? That doesn't necessarily mean if they don't have a home that they don't have access to some funds. They may have been employed. We don't know, because the individuals who were involved Well, they couldn't be found. But what we know is that allegedly that they'd called, I guess presumably from a cell phone, and they'd been calling from their alleged campsite. So, again, you know, a lot of people online are saying that this alleged call, whether or not it's real, was probably somehow linked to this Rick Dyer thing. Maybe it was a promotional stunt that was intended to support Dyer's claims. But if it appeared after he claimed to have made the kill, you know, a few important questions to ask are, first, did the people who made the call know that it in likelihood would be released to the public after it were made? And if not, wouldn't it be easier just to, of course, you know, release this story through another medium and claim that it was a dispatch call? It sounds legitimate, but, you know, how can you support the veracity of something like that? How can you prove it? You know, there is no real proof. And so, again, you know, I think that my gut tells me, although it's interesting, that it would probably have to be some sort of a hoax. Is it truly linked to what Dyer's claiming now as he's going around there and charging people to look at, you know, Fozzie Bear laying in a, you know, an upturned liquor cabinet? The whole thing's just pretty bizarre and pretty silly, in fact. So, you know, the folks are talking about it there in the chat room, and it is an interesting discussion. It is an interesting discussion. But again, this whole idea of hoaxing a Bigfoot find, you know, putting it under ice or putting it under glass and carrying it around and touring with it, this all goes back to the 1960s when Frank Hansen had been going around out there and promoting what he claimed he had gotten from an eccentric California millionaire. It was this Minnesota Iceman. Now, this alleged Iceman, which kind of made the made its rounds touring carnivals and fairs as an exhibit, it actually led to Hansen allegedly being detained by Canadian customs officials who were concerned about the fact that he might be transporting a cadaver. Well, the thing did look very human, and it drew the attention of cryptozoologists Ivan Sanderson and Bernard Heuvelmans. Now, Heuvelmans and Sanderson looked at the thing. They were allowed to examine this thing in a small room. Sanderson purportedly had to climb up onto it and lay on top of the glass to be able to get good photos of the face, but he did. He managed to get some really good photos, and he said what it looked like was that one of the eye sockets was completely empty and hollow. The second, it looked as though there may have still been an eye, but that the eye had popped out of the head and was lying out on the skin in front of the face. And this was in keeping with the idea that when this thing that had been kept under ice was shot, that there had been a bullet that had been fired into, I believe, what was the left eye, killing the creature and, of course, causing, an internal pressure to blast the other eye out of the face. So that was Sanderson's description of what he'd seen under ice. And he took photographs of it, and he mentioned something else very interesting. And there's a term for this, and unfortunately I don't recall what the actual term is. But what the creature that appeared under ice apparently displayed was, and I wish I could remember the term for this, but it's fur that like a squirrel or a similar animal reveals two colors, a lighter color closer, I guess, to the coat, and then it's darker on the outside. If anyone in the chat room knows the term for that might be helpful, because there's a technical term for it. Well, Sanderson said that as close as he could get to it, it appeared that the fur or that the hair on this thing resembled like hair that you would see on a squirrel or another animal like that. In other words, this is interesting because there are no known primate species, at least anything similar to a human, that would actually have that. And John Napier, who wrote about this in 1972, along with a lot of other people, had said that that seemed to make this less likely a legitimate variety of hominid species, because he said if it were anything human-like, it wouldn't have hair like that. It's not going to have hair, you know.
So is it kind of like possum hair?
Sort of, yeah.
Because, you know, possum hair is kind of bizarre because it seems to have like a white base coat, but then the rest of the hair is black.
Yeah, exactly. And that, there's a term for animals that have hair like that. And allegedly, the Iceman had actually exhibited that same feature with the hair that was
the possum. It was just George Jones.
Yeah, it was George Jones under ice. Yeah. So it's interesting because the two men, Heuvelmans and Sanderson, look at this thing. Now, Sanderson was pretty skeptical in that instance. He hoped that it was something legitimate, but he didn't rush out there to try and talk about it. Meanwhile, Bernard Heuvelmans goes, he publishes an article about this thing, and he proposes his taxonomical name for it. He proposes that we call it Homo pongoides. The FBI was informed subsequently because there was concern that this thing as human as it looked, might be an actual murder victim.
The whole idea is so weird. Toting around a dead body of anything and showing it around, that is just so weird.
Let me tell you something. What I just said is a very important point. First of all, if there were anything legitimate to this, science would be... Science is though science is a person. I would say that the scientific community would be interested if there were any potential for legitimacy. And if you're going to be legitimate yourself in carrying out the promotion of something like this, if somebody wants to go from town to town and charge money to see it versus present it to the scientific community and say, look, we have a valid specimen, this is real, yes, I am responsible for the recovery of this body, and now we need to protect any other existent, you know, members of the species. There's a way that you would legitimately handle this. In the past, when we've seen these hoaxes go on tour and people charged money to be able to see this thing, we know what the inevitable outcome is. You know, think about it. Hey, Danny,
I've got Steve Buscemi's dead twin brother on ice, guys. And you give me $5, you can see him.
Well, I mean, the Smithsonian was contacted. You know, primatologist John Napier had tried to get, you know, members of the Smithsonian at least to take it seriously enough to investigate, and very few of them would, which is interesting for another reason, because people often talk about Smithsonian cover-ups. I was contacted by a television agency today that's interested in possibly doing a show about Smithsonian cover-ups and said, yeah, I'll talk with you about that, but I'm less convinced that the Smithsonian's really involved in a cover-up. Because if you actually dig into some of these reports, I think that the Smithsonian, if there were a potential for legitimacy, would inevitably be interested. But here John Napier, primatologist at the time, who was active with the Smithsonian, had tried to get them to investigate it. But apparently, they wouldn't really get involved because of the likelihood of a hoax being involved. You know, and if an extraordinary claim of a giant or a Bigfoot body or something were to come up, I can't say the Smithsonian wouldn't get involved, but knowing how they reacted to the Iceman story, that says probably a lot about the likelihood of the Smithsonian's, you know, interesting involvement in claiming the bodies of dead creatures and things like that. I can't say that it would never happen, though, because Smokey Crabtree, as I've pointed out in the past, in his book Too Close to the Mirror, he claimed that he was brought the body of a creature that he said resembled what he thought the Falk monster would have been, and that sure enough, he said that when he began, again, taking this thing out and showing the body, and it wasn't a complete body, it was merely the skeletal remains is all. But when he began promoting this thing, and you know, he had said he wanted to be able to try and, you know, prove that this thing had existed. But, you know, and I'm, you know, don't mean to attack Smokey here, but I mean, he did the same thing that everybody who's allegedly had a body did, and he puts it on display and charges people to see it. That's immediately suspect to me. But he claims that the Smithsonian Institute contacted him and said they were coming to claim the body, and he had said to them, well, you better bring a lot of food, because if you come down here, you're going to be here for a while. And he said that they never showed up. So who knows, maybe the Smithsonian would show interest, but they didn't with the Minnesota Iceman. The FBI also, after being contacted with concern about whether a human cadaver was on ice and being toted around as a monkey or some sort of a relic hominid, they also decided not to investigate because of the likelihood that it was a hoax. But there are all these interesting dimensions that open up with these discussions about alleged Bigfoot bodies and things. Because there are reasons why an agency like the FBI might get involved. People think, oh, yeah, man, the men in black, they're going to go out there. They want to catch Bigfoot. No. Agencies are often interested in whether a law is being broken pertaining to charging people money, you know, and particularly carrying a business across state lines, or the actual promotion of something as something that it is not, i.e. fraud, or the potential that something that appears human but is purportedly a dead body, might actually be a dead body, and if it has a bullet wound or a gunshot wound through the eye, we have to wonder how that person, putting up air quotes, might have been killed. So yeah, there are reasons why official agencies would get involved in the investigation of something like this, and it doesn't have that much to do with whether or not Bigfoot exists.
I mean, I feel like there should be some sort of, I guess there aren't, but I feel like there should be some sort of law that keeps people from doing this. I mean, I know when you shoot an animal, you have to report it to the wildlife. Commission, and you have to like tag everything that you kill. You have to report it. So, I mean, I guess if you were to go out in the woods and find a dead bear and put it on ice and drive it around and show it to people, I guess you could legally, but it's really freaking weird.
I mean, think about that though. Dead bear on ice.
I mean,
$3 admission.
Kid,
Kid who wants to touch the dead bear.
Come in here, you can smell him for free.
Oh, my God.
Oh, Lord, well.
But, yeah, it's just a really bizarrely morbid happening.
It is really
strange.
Come
on in here and pay me money, see my dead Bigfoot.
Well, I'll tell you,
America.
Speaking of the smell of the thing, that's something that, you know, I interviewed Brad Steiger years ago, and that was one of the most interesting stories he ever told me, was that he said, because, see, there was a claim later that the actual body that Sandersons and Hwevelman had seen that prompted Hwevelman, he was so convinced that he goes and he writes a scientific article about this. Sanderson took these photos, and he was convinced the thing was legitimate, too, although some of the details he described, again, as later recounted by John Napier with regard to the coloration of the hair and whatnot, seemed to point away from the likelihood of its legitimacy. Nonetheless, Sanderson seemed convinced by this thing. And then later, the story gets really weird because supposedly, okay, the body was then retrieved, withdrawn at orders of, according to Frank Hansen, the promoter, he claimed it was withdrawn at the orders of the owner, the California-based millionaire, because it was getting too much attention and there was too much threat of public inspection. And supposedly, and this is interesting, supposedly a latex model was then reproduced and put out and allowed to go on display. And John Napier, even, who was very skeptical of the Iceman affair from the get-go, even Napier had said, if you examine Sanderson's original photos and then you look at the later images released of the supposed latex model, he said they look different. He said that there were the way that the teeth were available, the placement of certain elements, he said it actually did look different, noticeably different from the photos that were first taken by Ivan Sanderson. But he didn't think that the thing was actually a latex model that had been supplanted in place of the legitimate original. What Napier thought, and what this apparently also ended up being the position held by the Smithsonian, he said that they were satisfied, quote, that the creature is simply a carnival exhibit made of latex, rubber, and hair, and that the original model and the present so-called substitute are one and the same. That in likelihood, and this is Napier's surmisal, that the whatever the model had been was thawed, modified slightly, and then refrozen and put back out so it would look different from the one that Sanderson had taken photographs of.
Sounds like a lot of work.
Sounds like an awful lot of work, but, you know, that was his estimation. But this is what's interesting. When Sanderson and Hwevelman's went and looked at what was supposedly the original, they both claimed that the thing stunk, and that even through the ice, they said that there was a terrible odor in the room, and that that seemed to be evidence of an actual body to them. That they told to Brad Steiger, who Brad, of course, told me that he remembers getting the phone call from a very excited Ivan Sanderson saying, I've found it, my boy, I've found it, the thing I've searched an entire life for, proof that the abominable snowmen of America exist. And he was convinced. But that doesn't in itself constitute legitimacy. Now, the entire thing eventually died down because after the dummy shows up and goes up back out on the you know the carnival circuit, then it allegedly is burned up in a warehouse fire and disappears forever. That is until last year, in February, when allegedly the thing resurfaces and appears in an auction on eBay. The listing on the auction read, this is the actual sideshow gaff billed as the Minnesota Iceman by Frank Hansen in the 1960s. It's one-of-a-kind hoax that was fabricated by mid-20th century showmen. Or this is a... And it was allegedly purchased, and then, of course, I've actually confirmed this, it showed up on their website. It was purchased by the Austin, Texas-based Museum of the Weird. Steve Busti, the owner, then put it on display. And there it is, it's still encased in ice. But I would love, if this thing is legitimate, if it's still encased in ice, couldn't they thaw the ice and at least just take a look at the specimen that managed to fool Ivan Sanderson, that managed to fool Bernard Hwevelman's? The thing that had had both of these men so excited and that caused fury to erupt in cryptozoological circles for years and years, and that some people, because of the sordid history involving the alleged body and then the replacement and then the burning in the warehouse and now this thing that shows up again, how do we really know that the one that showed up on eBay is indeed the legitimate version of the original? How do we know that this is, you know, the surviving Minnesota Iceman and not just a very, very well done replica? There have been other replicas that certainly looked better than that piece of junk that Rick Dyer is carrying around. Have you ever seen the Yeti Burganoff, Caleb?
Is that a burger?
No. That's actually going to be an item on Taco Bell's new breakfast menu, the Yeti Burganoff. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Didn't know he was Hispanic.
Well, that's actually Russian, my friend.
Oh.
Burganoff, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeti.
But no, I'm saying Russian Hispanic because it's Taco Bell.
Well, you know, could be some sort of a strange haunted relic. I don't know. You know, Canadian goat meat mixed with a little bit of, you know, Sasquatch hair, peppered with Yeti droppings.
Dude, I'm already hungry.
Yeah.
You don't have to do this to me.
I know. Well, you know, the interesting thing is, and actually, people, you can just Google Yeti Burganoff, and you'll be able to kind of see what I'm talking about. There are a lot of hoaxes that have come out over the years that are kind of a play on that Bigfoot on ice that goes back to the 1960s. And the idea may go back even earlier, you know, in popular fiction and films and things like that. But, you know, in the actual, you know, well, you know, actually, yeah, you could go back maybe just a little further because, you know, Homer Tate, the guy who was creating those little mummies out there in the desert, Homer Tate was another guy who he'd go out in the desert and he'd find little bits of animal bone and things like that, and he'd take mud and sticks and actual, you know, sometimes bone and teeth from little animals in the desert, and he would make little mummies and things out of them.
Weird.
He'd put them in a coffin, and he'd sell these things as sideshow attractions. Ralph Lael, down in the Linville Gorge, had one in his outer space rock shop off Highway 181 that Tim Beckley took a photograph of, and for a long time in UFO circles, it was, you know, alleged that this guy, Ralph Lael, had an alien body down there in his rock shop, when in truth, if you look at the photos, it looked almost exactly like one of old Homer Tate's sideshow attractions that were completely, they were almost like paper mache mummies with real teeth put in them.
Do you remember my favorite hoax ever was the guy and the lady that said they found the dinosaur eggs and raptor popped out and like ran off, and he was so full of crap.
A lot of people are unaware of that one. That one's one that kind of...
That was like back in the 90s, wasn't it?
That's one that kind of, you know, that people probably don't know a lot about, but, you know, it was, I can't remember the show that aired that, but, you know, it's funny because these programs...
I feel like it was like Extra or something like that.
Inside Edition.
Yeah, one of those shows like that, but that guy was such a fart.
It's hilarious because, I mean, yeah, the story, a lot of those programs back in the 90s, that was a special time because you had sightings, you had encounters, you had unsolved mysteries, you had all these shows that really overtly sensationalized all these claims of the unusual.
Perfectly campy.
Yeah, exactly, but not in the cool way like In Search Of was back in the 70s or Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World was in the 80s. No, these really took this kind of a lifetime drama kind of a feel, but it was nonetheless still, you know, creepy. I remember my cousin and I talking about how we didn't even like the theme music of Unsolved Mysteries. It scared us so bad, you know.
what was the one with the famous hamburger faced Bigfoot looking down at the kid at the campfire? That wasn't on In Search Of, was it?
That, my friend, actually was a documentary. The entire thing's on YouTube. It's called The Mysterious Monsters, and yeah, that was the one that was narrated by, what was the actor that played Mr. Phelps on the original Mission Impossible? His name's slipping my mind, but he I think it was Mr. Phelps. But anyhow, he narrated the thing, and it was highly scripted, you know. But yeah, there were some choice moments in that. No, this thing that you're talking about that was on Inside Edition or one of these shows, the claim was that these people had been unearthing, you know, something in their backyard and everything, and they found these little dinosaur eggs, and that these little creatures that looked like velociraptors hatched out, and they had the photos of obviously eggs and yolk broken over these things, and they're holding like a little Tyrannosaurus Rex toy.
Yeah.
You know?
That literally looked like the Jurassic Park toys.
They looked like the little action figures, yeah, from Jurassic Park or something like that. And so the story goes that they continued to nurse these little babies, these little baby dinosaurs, until these things eventually broke out of the shed that they had been staying in. And they went on to say that the dinosaurs would return, and they tore down the shed, and that they said, I love it, because the episode, in full seriousness, ends with an interview with the man, and he's saying, I'm afraid one day I'm going to look out that window, and one night there's going to be something big out there that I don't want to see. And that, my friends, is why I'm staying in the bunker. I'm not coming out. I'm not going to deal with Gojira. I'm not going to deal with Bigfoot hoax. I'm not going to deal with the Ice Mammy or the Space Mummy. I'm going to stay right here where it's safe in the Graylian Bunker. And I hope you guys stay here with us every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern or on the podcast via Stitcher and iTunes. Caleb, thanks for being a part of the program tonight.
Thanks for having me, my guy.
And for all you night owls out there who are listening live, be sure and tune in at 3 a.m. East Coast time. I'll be on Coast to Coast talking about the Ghost Rockets with George Norrie. On behalf of yours truly, John Anderson, Matt Oakley, Caleb Hanks, Dick Oakley, And, of course, well, myself, the Mouth of the South. It is the Graylian Report. We bid you adieu, my friends. And until next time, stay strange.
You've been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.